Good evening. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. I'm along with Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. We run a thing called the TechNet in which we try to answer people's questions. With the help of our friends and other people who sign in, we teach each other this complicated hobby of ham radio. As you've heard me say before, there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. And FM repeater work that you're listening to right now is just one of the 26 kinds. Sometimes we discuss a few of the 25 other kinds of ham radio. They're all related by wireless technology and computers and things like that. Transmission lines, feed lines, transmitters, receivers, propagation. We discuss all of that. Subjects that are appropriate for the ham, for the TechNet, are essentially any subject of interest to ham radio operators. So that includes all kinds of electronics, modern goodies, and so on. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this: WS2N, all and yes. So if you have any questions or comments, give us your call letters, name, and that yes right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W-D-2-C-K-2-R-Y.
Joe.
Yes, I have a question.
Yes. Okay, we got Bill and Joe. B-2-R-Y-Y. Because they came in by different means, we heard both voices on top of each other very nicely. Okay, Bill and Joe, anyone else? My goodness. Is everybody out to, with their barbecue tonight? Is that what's going on? Anyone else assigned into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Good evening, Dick. M2EO. No question.
Okay, Rich with a no for now, but you wait and see. We get rolling, he's going to hear something of interest to him, and he'll have a question or a comment. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2RSF, good evening. The name is Tom. No question. Calling from the county of Monmouth in the Mobile. Sandy Hook National Park Service. Over.
Very fine, Tom. Monmouth is now represented. Anyone else?
Hey, good evening, everybody. This is Katie White.
That man didn't give us his name. I'm having fun with him. Okay, hey Bill, you're the number one on the runway. We got a beautiful flea market coming up, I think it's June 1st at Briarcliff College. My guess is you're going to be there with your table of goodies and with all your bells on. And what would you like to discuss tonight? WB2CUK, the man who usually runs our swapping shop, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. K2RIW in the net, WB2CUK. Nothing relating to the HamFest, but yes, I will be at the HamFest, but I've just been watching the live coverage on the Science Channel of the Phoenix Mars lander, and everything seems to have gone well. It landed. They got all the signals, you know, that it landed, and they're waiting to open the solar panels. What I would like to know, and maybe I've had my head in a Martian sand for a long time, I didn't even realize they had satellites orbiting Mars. And from what I'm hearing, they send the signal from the landed spacecraft up to an orbiting satellite, I guess to be used as a repeater, and sent back to Earth. Well, that, I'd like to know is possibly what frequencies they use, what modes they use, and when they start transmitting pictures, if there would be any way of intercepting that. I'm sure NASA keeps all these things a deep, dark secret, but there must be people that scan the RF universe and know this stuff. So that's my question, Dick. It may be very naive, but that's on my mind tonight. Now, over to you.
Darn good question, Bill. That's deep into the subject of radio, long-range communication, and so on. Quite often, during the active portion of NASA communicating with their space probes that are on or going around Mars, quite often Mars is as far away as 300 or 400,000 miles. The sun is only 92 million miles from us. I said 3,000 or 400, 3 or 400 million miles. Here we go. The sun is 92 million miles from us. Mars is quite a bit further out. I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to guess that Mars is around 480 million miles from the sun. So when Mars is on the opposite side of the sun, you add their distance to the sun, our distance to the sun, you come up with some pretty big numbers. To send a radio signal that far, you better have a pretty good sized dish, a pretty high frequency, and a reasonable amount of power. The nearest object that you and I know about a lot is Spirit and Opportunity, those two rover cars. And they don't have a very big dish on board. They got a rather simple quadrihelix antenna that communicates from the spacecraft that's on the ground at Mars, communicates up to one of two or three satellites that are in orbit. The satellite in orbit does a store and retour and forward. In other words, it records on the equivalent of a tape recorder the information from the lander craft, then on its dish, which is typically quite a few feet in diameter, running at around X-band frequency, 8.8 gigahertz, I think it is roughly, and a number of amateurs who are very well equipped have heard the carrier of the 8.8 gigahertz signal from Mars orbit. A number of amateurs, if you were a member of the microwave reflector, which is run by Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, and various members over the last year have talked about listening to the downlink signal on 8.8 gigs from NASA missions. So most of the time, the high rate data goes from the lander craft up to the satellite in orbit. The satellites in orbit are usually there for mapping reasons as well as acting as a repeater. They, in turn, with their 10-watt transmitter and their, I'm going to pick a number, 3 or 4 foot diameter dish, carefully aim that signal back to Earth, and because you've got a lot more signal-to-noise ratio with the higher gain antenna and the greater power and the dish that's carefully aimed at the Earth, you get a lot more signal, therefore a lot more data rate. Each of the spacecraft on the ground have a backup mode by which they can communicate directly from the space
repeater. Repeater. Cancel.
They have a mode by which they can communicate directly from the spacecraft on the ground to Earth. That's the good news. The bad news is that because the power is lower, because the antenna gain is lower, therefore the signal-to-noise ratio is much lower, therefore the only way you can get the data through that channel reliably is to drastically slow down the data. I'm talking by, you know, numbers like 1,000 to 1 slower data. Very similar to what we amateurs do. When the signal gets weaker and weaker, we go down to very slow speed Morse code when you're doing manual moon bounce, for instance, with a really threshold signal. As the signal gets stronger and stronger, you can send higher and higher speed data, eventually radio teletype, eventually pictures. So that's what's going on here. With every one of our spacecraft, even the Voyagers that went beyond Pluto, you can command up to the spacecraft what data rate it's going to talk back to you on. So as you know the spacecraft is getting further and further away, in the case of Voyager, you command it into a lower data rate mode. Therefore, you can use a more narrow band receiver bandwidth. Therefore, you can tolerate a weaker signal and still get a reasonable bit error rate. So the amount of information you can put into a channel is primarily a function of what signal-to-noise ratio have you got, how much power you're transmitting, how much antenna gain, and how much distance. So yeah, all of these spacecraft are using this repeater mode, and it works extremely well. Now, as you already read one article in Newsday, and you're going to read a couple of more articles in Newsday, a very significant piece of Long Island technology is on that Phoenix spacecraft that landed at the North Pole of Mars. And it's going to be looking for water with its backhoe and whatever. It's going to dig through the ice and look for water, and then bring some of those chunks of water, let me drop, inside of the spacecraft, in which it's going to melt it in an oven, and then look for the constituents of that water, like biological material, to find out was anything ever alive on Mars. However, the lenses that are on the Phoenix spacecraft were coated by the firm in I can't think of the name of the town right now, Hapag, which is called Spectrum Thin Films, run by Tony Piera, who is a significant member of the Astronomical Society of Long Island. Tony, with his beautiful company that puts coatings onto lenses and coats mirrors for telescopes and whatever, he's got a significant business doing that. He coated those lenses that are on the Phoenix spacecraft with a very exotic multi-layer coating so that the light going through those lenses goes through with much higher efficiency and much less of it gets reflected. So, as I said before, you'll be reading more about a piece of Long Island technology is on Mars right now. Don, good question, Bill, and I bet you got some more. Go to B2CUK, K2RIW on the TechNet.
And WS2N is here.
Paul, and we're gonna have Paul give us a little bit more of the information. He's got more of the details than I do. But first, Bill, back to you for any fill or further questions on what you just asked. You got it, Bill.
All right, Dick. Well, that's very interesting. You seem to know a lot about it. And I haven't really been following it too much, but I did see the advertising a couple of days ago that Science Channel would be having it live, and they were all gathered around their monitors there in Pasadena. And very interesting. 8.8 gig. I don't think I could put a satellite dish up. I think they have zoning things here about putting a satellite dish up, but it would be interesting to try and intercept that. But I don't think I'd be able to do it. Anyway, over to the other station. Thanks for your info. Hopefully we'll see you at the Handfest coming up on Sunday. Yeah, this is WBTC UK, and I'll be listening. Back to you, Dick.
It's not as difficult as you think, Bill. Many of those guys that are listening to that signal using what used to be a television receive-only terminal, the slightly larger kind of satellite dishes that were popular 10 and 15 years ago, the 8 and 10 foot diameter type thing. That with a good low noise preamplifier into a receiving converter that you can buy from Down East Microwave, where you can go to various places that will show you the schematic that you can build it. That converts down to usually 2 meters as the first IF, and into your 2 meter all mode receiver. You can listen to that carrier from that spacecraft that's on the way to Mars or circling Mars and whatever. So, a number of amateurs have done that. It's a real fun thing to do. To listen to a signal from 300 million miles away, you can start bragging about the QRRPPP, if you know what I mean, real weak signal type reception and lots of miles per watt, so to speak. These guys are really building the equipment for other purposes, like X-band moonbound, and by just retuning the converter, by plugging in on the crystal, maybe retuning the front end a little bit, while building a separate preamplifier, they can also listen to these spacecraft. To my knowledge, none of the amateurs have demodulated the downlink signal, which requires a greater signal-to-noise ratio than their dish can do. NASA is using 250-foot diameter dishes to do this work to make sure they get very high signal-to-noise ratio. The Goldstone dish, for instance, is the one that's being used to do an awful lot of the downlink. Paul, why don't you tell us a little bit more about the Phoenix spacecraft? I wasn't smart enough to watch that program this afternoon, and so I know that it went through 9 minutes of hell, as they call it. In other words, at the instant you first encounter the atmosphere at Mars, and you're doing that at some god-awful number like 20,000 miles an hour, and the heat shield slows it down to the point where you can deploy a small drogue parachute. That slows it down to the point where you can deploy a larger parachute. Then you jettison the heat shield. Then you come down to the right distance from the planet by way of the onboard ground-bouncing radar. And the radar tells you when you're the right number of feet off the ground. And then you blast your rockets to really slow it down to a couple of feet per second in order to settle down on the surface without damaging the spacecraft. That 9 minutes of sequence is all done automatically because at the speed of light, round trip wise, you're 15 minutes or 20 minutes away from what's happening. If you saw something going wrong and you say, hey, stop and do this instead, by the time you send the message to the spacecraft, the event is already over. So it's all automated. The NASA scientists, all they can do is chew their nails, watch the displays, and pray that everything goes right. And when it does come down on the
repeater, timeout,
When it does come down on the Martian surface, successfully survives, sends back pictures, starts deploying its antenna, its cameras, and whatever. All kinds of cheers go up there at the Pasadena at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is the division of NASA, which does most of that control operation. So tell us some more of the details, Paul, and don't spare any of the fine details. WS2N, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. And yeah, as far as receiving that, even if you had that whole setup, you know, right now it would be good there. It's 50 degrees above the horizon, so. But as the Earth turns, of course, you're going to need somebody 120 degrees offset with the same setup and another 120 degrees around the Earth offset to get continuous coverage. And then I guess you could link your buddies through the internet so you get coverage that way. But yeah, that would be a tough deal. But right now you could do it. If you had the equipment, it's right above our heads. And the transmission goes on UHF from the surface up to the orbiters. Just above the amateur band, actually. It's 450, 470, or something like that. Megahertz up to the orbiters, and then, like you said, X band, and you know, coming back. The repeaters in Mars orbit right now. Actually, there's as far as last year, there was four, but one has ceased to stop working after 8-9 years of operation, and the one that stopped operating is the Mars Global Surveyor. But this signal was being picked up as it went through the Mars atmosphere by Mars Odyssey. Let me drop it. We have Mars Odyssey up there. We have the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That is a real super big satellite. That's the latest one that went up. It's getting all the fine pictures that they used for locating the landing site. In fact, they moved the landing site a little bit a month ago because they saw a bulge. You can see the bulge on Mars. And it was a little too close to them, so they moved it back a little bit. And then you have the Mars Express, which was sent up by European Space Agency, also in orbit around Mars. All three functioning very well. And, of course, you've got the two Mars rovers riding around on the planet, one on one side and one on the other, Spirit and Opportunity. This thing here, 3 minutes before the net, Dick, that's why I'm late, was the actual landing. Of course, it landed 16 minutes earlier, 16-minute radio transmission to get to Earth. I watched it on CNN and recording it as well on CNN, also recording it on the Science Channel. Like the other fellow said there, 2-hour special tonight, so I'll review that later, which is nice. They show the equipment, they show the, all the test equipment, and how it's going to be operating for the next 3 months. It's a 3-month planned mission, working on solar panels. It went well. It's disconnected from its crew stage on time. They got that signal back at JPL. Then a few minutes later, they waited for the parachute to deploy to do that. One piece comes off. I don't see a drone parachute on this one. And then the main parachute comes out as it's slowing down 1,100 miles an hour. The heat shield itself, before that happened, gets up to 2,500 degrees. Then eventually the heat shield has to separate. As it's coming down, these are all pyrotechnic devices that have to go off. As it's coming down, that exposes its leg. The leg has to unfurl. And then the back shell actually has to come off with the parachute. That has to disconnect because that's going to expose the body of the lander. As it gets closer, like you said, Dick, the radars come on. They showed that. It was detected that the radars came on for letting them know how close they are to landing or dropping. And then the 12 motor rockets came on. They're pulsing rockets. They don't come on and run continuously. They're constantly pulsing. And if they need a little bit more on one side or the other, that would just pulse a little bit more than the other one surrounding the bottom of the spacecraft. The legs eventually collapse a little bit when it hits the planet, shutting the rocket motors down. And then, last I heard, the solar panels were did not open yet. They have to wait about 15, 20 minutes for that, because the rocket motors create a lot of dust on the planet, and they don't want the dust to eventually collect on top of the solar panels. So they're going to wait 15 minutes. It's probably open by now. Hopefully that goes well. But it's the 7 minutes of terror, as they call it, went successfully well. It's a big difference than the Mars Polar Lander that they tried back in 1999, as it was. The Mars Polar Lander was supposed to do the same thing, land in the northern part of the planet. They didn't have all the sophistication with radio transmissions to know exactly what was going on minute to minute. That was one of the things that they corrected. This way, in case this thing failed, they would know more accurately what went wrong more quickly. It was a big question of really what went wrong with the Mars Polar Lander. Turns out they believe that when it got to a couple hundred feet above the surface, there was a signal that told the Mars Polar Lander that it had landed, and it shouldn't have happened, and the motor shut off, and they probably crashed into the surface. This one went well. It's on the surface. It's got a big scoop, like you said. It's going to dig into the surface. It's going to hit the ice. The ice is going to be like concrete. It's on the back of the scoop. It's this auger type of thing. It's going to kind of like chop away at it, and these pieces will come up and actually go into the back of the shovel, and when it's got enough material on board, we'll put it into a little box, and they can heat it up and find out about water, find out about organics. It's got a mass spectrometer on board, find out the materials, what it's made of, and all of that, over the next 3 months. They haven't had a soft landing like this since 1976, the Viking mission. Again, one was on one side of the planet, one was on the other. They were successful. They operated, one operated for like 6 years. But this thing is only planned to run about 3 months. So that's pretty much it, Dick.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Tell me this, Paul. Do you know the approximate weight of the Phoenix lander? And was there a prediction as to how long it will be before it sends back the first photograph of what the terrain looks like where it landed? Back to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah, about a 900-pound machine. The rovers, Opportunity and Spirit, were lighter, smaller. They were able to incorporate that in the big airbags, and that's why they bounced along the surface to their location. This was too heavy. They couldn't do that, and they needed to have a soft landing with the 900-pound machine. By the way, it's got a couple of cups of water with it too, to mix with the material that they put on. When they test, I should mention that as well. Camera's going to come out similar to Opportunity and Spirit. It's going to come up about 5-6 feet in the air when it deploys. That will be able to turn and give a panoramic view, stereoscopic, of course, to cameras on board to do that. It's got a weather station, and it's got a lot more than Spirit and Opportunity had on board. The only problem with this is it can't go riding around. It does not have wheels, that's back.
But is there a prediction roughly how long? I think you said it's going to be a couple of hours before it deploys its solar cells. Then I guess it's going to deploy the boom for the camera. So I guess we're a few hours away from that first photograph of what the surrounding terrain looks like. Is that true, Paul?
They'll probably have that before 11 o'clock tonight. So if you watch the news, I'm sure they'll have it on, the first photograph. 15 minutes for the solar panel, so I'm sure they're deployed by now. That was 15 minutes ago. Probably about 10, 15 minutes ago, I'm sure they were opened up. Unless there's something wrong. I'm not sitting in front of a TV right now, so I don't know. Hopefully that all works well. But the main part, the engineering part, that went well for the land of things. And now they just got to make sure everything else goes well with this spacecraft. Usually they send, two spacecraft. There's only one this time, Vic, so they put all their money into this one craft. By the way, it's a little less than $500 million deal for the Phoenix inspection.
That's worth it. Let me think now. We have a third of a billion people, $500 million. It's a dollar and a half per man, woman, and child. I'm willing to invest in that. I've gotten my dollar's worth already, Bill. I think the latitude at which it landed is equivalent to Greenland on the Earth. It's not really at the North Pole of Mars. I think Mars is experiencing Northern Hemisphere summer at this time. And so I believe they're not completely... If they were really at the North Pole, then, of course, in the wintertime, there would be days in complete darkness, and the solar panels wouldn't do any good. Because they're at the latitude of Greenland, I believe they will be getting sunshine all year round. So even though it's planned to be a three-month mission, I think the possibility exists it'll go considerably beyond that. I'm guessing that the primary source of power is the solar cells. I don't think there's a nuclear generator on this one to act as a backup power supply. Is that approximately true, Bill? Go ahead. Paul?
Yeah, you have it right, Dick. And, they've got these, what's called round solar panels. They kind of unfurl kind of like a fan. They're all folded up like a fan, and it's going to come out two solar panels. Of course, you've got your onboard batteries. And the onboard batteries work good when it's disconnected from the cruise section. Cruise section has solar panels on it as well for a trip to Mars. That's disconnected. Batteries took over, internal batteries for landing. So, I'm sure it was 3 months for Opportunity and Spirit. It's over 4 years. That was 2004 January when those two things landed. So that sounds good. 62 degrees north latitude is what I remember reading a while back.
Which sounds approximately Greenland, northern of Labrador and probably in the Greenland area. And so far enough north that there'll be permafrost and ice. I think they believe there's frozen carbon dioxide, and there's a strong belief that there is frozen water in the area where it landed. In fact, I think that's one of the major constituents of life that they're looking for. The backhoe will be digging through the substance that they claim is going to be as hard as sidewalk, and they hope it's going to be frozen ice, maybe a mixture of frozen ice and carbon dioxide. They bring it inside, put it in a small oven, cook the materials, maybe add water to it, and see if there's any living biological materials, amino acids, or even the possibility of, I guess, bacterial life. So have you heard any predictions as to what the prediction of frozen carbon dioxide versus frozen water might be at the latitude where they landed? Back to you, Paul.
I would think the frozen carbon dioxide would be further north. By the way, I have a globe on my desk. Southern Greenland, 60 degrees. There you go, Dick. So, they'll probably dig through a little dirt first, and then I guess they're going to hit the hard concrete. They have the capability of going down a think two or 3 feet. It's an eight long arm. It's about 8 foot long, a backhoe type of thing. So, I mean, that might take a long time to do what they want to do, but you know, it's a machine. They'll work it probably whatever it takes without killing the batteries on board and let it go and go. But they've got a super hard auger, and same people that developed the rat on the Spirit and Opportunity, the drilling gizmo that takes the rind off of rock before they analyze it. They've got microscopes on board to take pictures of this stuff when they put it in the tester and all. So it's a pretty neat machine. I was hoping it was going to have a microphone on board. Mars Polar Lander had a microphone, and we would have heard the wind as it went through the atmosphere. That was the one that crashed in 99, but it just wasn't out of the mic. That would have been fun there.
It sure would have. I think Mars has something like 0.7% of the atmospheric pressure we have here on Earth. There's very little of the atmosphere left on Mars because Mars has so little magnetic field. It doesn't have a magnetic field to protect it from the solar wind. See, all those solar wind particles that the sun is sending out continuously are charged particles. They hit our magnetic field of our Earth and get deflected, and therefore it doesn't hit our atmosphere. Mars has so little magnetic field that all those particles of the solar wind are continuously hitting the upper atmosphere of Mars, peeling away that atmosphere and sending it out into space. And so Mars has been losing its atmosphere for millions of years because of a lack of a magnetic field. And as such, it doesn't have very much air pressure, 0.7% of the Earth's air pressure, if I remember correctly. However, when the sun shines on some portions of Mars versus another and you get a thermal effect, that wind will sometimes blow 250 miles an hour. In fact, I believe quite a bit of dust collected on the solar panels of Spirit and Opportunity, and one of those 250 mile an hour winds come along, even though it's a very tenuous wind, it blows away the dust. I think that's the explanation for how periodically the dust on the solar panels of Spirit and Opportunity decreases the solar output, the voltage output, the current output. And then all of a sudden you get a great big jump back to normal when the wind gets up, when the dust gets blown away. I wonder if you've read some reports along those lines, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, this WS2N. That was a big thing. They didn't expect that. In fact, they thought the Mars winds would, collect, when they started up, they would put dust onto the air. Solar panels decrease the output. But what happened was, that to some extent that did happen. But you'd get these gusts, and they would clear the panels off. They'd go from like 20% or so capability. And one time they went up back to 80 or 90% after a year that they were on the planet. It does happen quite a bit. That's one of the reasons these things keep going. Riding and going, and it's unbelievable. One is in Victoria Crater, doing a lot of work opportunity, and Spirit is up on the hills. It's unbelievable that they're very happy. They had Steve Squires interviewing him the whole time on CNN tonight, and because he's an expert in the field, comes out of Ithaca, Cornell, and he was in charge of the Mars Spirit and Opportunity mission. So he was pretty informative about this mission. And very good. I'm looking at the signals. Dick, I'm gonna go over to the other repeater. Signals are down a little bit. Probably not getting it. Good. Back to you, Dick. WSY.
Whether you switch over is your choice, Paul. You sound good on this machine. You're sounding good. Maybe you're not getting a good signal in return, but the machine's getting a good signal from you. Okay, quite possibly Paul will have some further space information for us later on. Depending on how long Joe keeps us booked. WB2RYY, Joe, what would you like to discuss tonight? We'll discuss anything except frequency accuracy. That was a joke. You got it, Joe.
WHYY, name's Joe. Okay. I have a question concerning measuring insertion loss on a transmission line versus return loss. Okay, so that's to start with.
Okay, Joe. One of the things, basic pieces of information that's not obvious to an awful lot of people, only when you take a good course in electromagnetic theory and they teach you the principle of reciprocity, the law of reciprocity, do you suddenly realize that almost every transmission line you and I ever use, I don't care if it's made out of twin lead, zip cord, coax cable, whatever, thin line, coplanar waveguide, trough line, strip line, tri-plate strip line, all of the transmission lines you and I have ever used have got some weird characteristics and some beautiful characteristics. One of the weird characteristics is that if the transmission line is not terminated with a pure resistor that is at the so-called characteristic impedance of that line, if you terminate it with anything else, a lower resistor, a higher resistor, or any amount of reactance, then the input impedance you see on that transmission line gets quite complicated. There's some fancy formulas with a whole bunch of sines and cosines and hyperbolic tangents and whatever that'll tell you what it's going to look like on the input end if you know the length of the line and the nature of what load you put on the far end. And the Smith chart also helps you do that. So transmission lines, if you load them with anything but the characteristic impedance, they give you funny things at the input depending on the length of the line and the frequency you're at and so on. That's one piece of information. From that piece of information where the line has an impedance transforming characteristic, that's what I just described, you would think that if you put a pure short circuit or an open circuit at the end of the transmission line, that's considerably worse than putting a mismatched load. That's what common sense would lead you to believe. Something good happens when you do that. Put a pure short circuit or a pure open circuit at the end of the line, and all of the power that gets there, every single bit of it, will reflect back toward the transmitter. That's one piece of good information. The second piece of good information is that as long as you're using the feed line, the transmission line, within its linear region, you're not running real high power where it's getting hot and arcing over and doing anything like that. As long as it's running in its linear region, the transmission line has a magic property where the signal that flows forward from the transmitter toward the antenna and any reflected signal that comes from the antenna back to the transmitter, the transmission line keeps the forward signal and the reverse signal thoroughly separated. And I'm not kidding. There is no connection within the transmission line itself of the forward flowing signal and the reverse flowing signal. You can do anything you want to modulate a signal going backwards compared to the signal going forward. The signal going forward will not be affected in any way.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The signal flowing in the opposite direction will not be affected in any way when you change the signal flowing in the first direction. So it keeps the signals forward and reverse thoroughly separate. Beautiful magic characteristic. Therefore, I'm going to give you an example. If my particular transmission line at my particular frequency happens to have 1 decibel of insertion loss, it's a 100-foot long piece of, we'll say, RG8. I'm using it at some frequency. Maybe the frequency is 50 megacycles. And so it might have 1 decibel of loss for a signal flowing forward. If I put a perfect short circuit or a perfect open circuit at the far end of the signal that got there that's 1 decibel weaker, all of that signal will reflect back. It will experience a 1 exactly dB of insertion loss in the reverse direction. So what comes back to me in the shack, in that example, will be 2 dB weaker. So therefore, if I've got good instrumentation in the shack, a bird directional watt meter can do it very nicely. Directional couplers can do it. A network analyzer, an antenna analyzer. There's lots of instrumentation you can use in the shack.
VISWA meters and so on, where I can measure the forward power and the reverse power, or forward voltage and reverse voltage, and do a calculation. Doesn't matter. Whatever I measure in the shack as apparent insertion loss, I divide it in two, and that is the insertion loss of the signal flowing forward in the transmission line. You could, if you want to, double check this. You climb the tower, you open up the connector that goes to the antenna, you put your power measuring device there after having calibrated it down in the shack, and by your handy talkie, you tell somebody to turn on the rig in the shack, and you measure the power at the far end. You don't have to do that. You can do it by putting a short circuit or an open circuit, go back to the shack and measure the two-way insertion loss. So maybe that's going to create a couple more questions. Maybe you've heard all this before. Maybe that's close to what you were asking. So be A2RYY, K2RIW, you got it, Joe.
Okay, Dick, yes, I have heard this before. Yes, I'm familiar with this procedure. And yes, it's going to lead to some more questions right down the same path here. Okay? Take a piece of transmission line, say a piece of hard line, because that's, you know, a good thing to use it in a ham shack, you know, if you can afford hard line compared to coax. But it doesn't have to be hard line. Say you had a very hard bend in the cable, and that bend in the cable caused you to see a return loss of the entire circuit loaded with a 50 ohm load of, say, minus 15 dB, so that's about approximately 5% return loss. Minus 15 dB return loss, about 5% being reflected back as far as power, I believe, how the ratio works. If you had a bend in the cable that would generate that compared to having water or condensation in the line or at the far end of the connector that generated the same kind of return loss indication on your instrumentation, my question would be, would you get the same throughput insertion loss from point to point? Does water cause any kind of different insertion loss as you measure its reflected characteristics?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes, yes, yes. Water is an extremely different substance compared to a bump in the cable. A bump in the cable, by the way, would have to be pretty extreme. You actually study how much you have to dent the outer conductor of a hardline piece of cable towards the center conductor, and for how many inches you would have to do it before you would make a significant difference in the cable. Let me give you an example on that one. If, for instance, I opened up your piece of cable at 50 ohms, and I had a piece of 10 ohm impedance cable, which, by the way, is a product made by Uniform Tube semi-rigid cable, I could plug in a piece of 10 ohm cable at the end of your 50 ohm cable, and I make that 10 ohm cable, let me pick a number, 3 inches long. Then I go back to 50 ohm cable for the rest of the run all the way up the tower. You and I would look at that and say, boy, that's horrible. A piece of 10 ohm impedance is the equivalent of having a dent in the cable where the center conductor and the shield are almost touching each other, a 32nd or a 64th of an inch apart, for a 3-inch length, as if you had rolled a bulldozer over that piece of cable, so to speak. You would look at that piece of cable and say, boy, that's horrible. However, you study that on a Smith chart or some of the other techniques by which you can study it. And what really counts is how many wavelengths of the wrong impedance cable is there. 3 inches at 2 meters would be, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but maybe it's a 20th of a wavelength. And you calculate what happens with a 20th of a wavelength of cable with 20 with 10 ohm impedance instead of 50 ohm impedance, and the net result is probably going to be something like a 15 dB reflection coefficient, just like your example. A 15 dB reflection coefficient means that the forward going signal is probably attenuated by 3/10 of a dB. But that's all. A 2-to-1 VISWA, which is a 9.5 dB reflection coefficient, only loses you a little bit less than half a dB. So this is this great big dent that you and I would lose a lot of sleep over it. We would probably lose 2 or 3/10 of a dB in the forward going signal due to the dent. Ugliest looking dent in the world. Bulldozer running over your hard line. And as long as the center conductor and shield don't touch each other, as long as there's a little bit of foam in there, so to speak, in that crushed cable, that signal will flow through there and keep right on going, as long as you don't do it for a quarter of a wavelength. Do it for a quarter wavelength, and now it gets more severe. But do it for a small fraction of a wavelength, you can get away with murder. Because the dent itself is not a loss mechanism. However, you put three drops of water in the middle of a type N connector. You open up your type N connector, you put three drops of water in there.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You put three drops of water in there with your eyedropper and close it back up. I'm not sure what it'll do at 2 meters, but I've made the measurement at 432. The water itself creates 10 decibels of insertion loss. Not because of the visuar it creates, but because of the absorption it creates. Water at VHF and UHF frequencies is a dummy load material. It absorbs RF energy like no tomorrow. The actual water molecule is a dipole molecule. You got the H2O, there are two hydrogens and one oxygen, and it makes a dipole molecule. In other words, one end of the molecule is negative, the other end of the molecule is positive. On each half cycle of the RF energy that's going into the water molecule tries to flip back and forth and follow the RF energy. And it does it with loss, because it does it with a phase lag. It can't keep up. It can't move fast enough. It's the water that's in your food that does all of the cooking in your microwave oven. The RF energy is absorbed by the water. The water tries to, the dipole molecule of the water tries to follow the microwave signal. It doesn't do a very good job. It does it in a lossy manner, and it gets hot, and it dissipates the RF energy. It converts the RF energy that hits the water into heat. So water in your cable, particularly if the water is properly distributed throughout the foam of a high-class cable, the water can give you no recognizable standing wave ratio, but it can give you a huge insertion loss. So water is really nasty stuff. If the water is pooled in one spot and it's not being insulated, your ohm meter from center conductor to ground to shield on the cable might show you the presence of the water. Real good cable will measure 10 megohms and higher. You start getting drops of water in the connector and you'll start coming down to 100,000 ohms real fast and below. That's if the water is in a conducting area where it's bridging the gap between center conductor and shield, like in the middle of the type N connector. If the water is distributed throughout the foam of flexible cable, evenly distributed throughout the little cells of the foam, the water is sitting there giving you insertion loss, but it will not show up on your ohm meter. It will not show up on your visuar meter. So if you suspect you've got water in your system, there's a slim chance your visuar meter will show it to you. There's a high probability it will not. Really nasty stuff. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. So it seems like there's no direct way to, for measuring return loss, to tell if you've got any contamination from moisture or water in your cable without doing an actual physical end-to-end loss measurement. Is that correct?
That is correct. You're either going to measure the signal going in and what comes out by going to the two ends, or you're going to put a short or an open circuit at the far end and measure the two-way return loss. But you have to measure real insertion loss of the cable in order to find out if water is killing it. Water is really nasty stuff. The best example you can give of that is that it was the first dummy load that was ever used at microwave frequencies. A guy named Southworth, somewhere around 1937, working at Bell Laboratories, wanted to start experimenting with the stuff called waveguide. I think his very first piece of waveguide was a piece of aluminum downspout tubing from his house. He used it as a piece of waveguide. He wanted to send a signal down there. He measured what cut out to the other end, and that worked nice. Then he wanted to make a dummy load. As a dummy load, he put the piece of downspout tubing into a trough of water at a very shallow angle, so that the water now represented a wedge of water inside of the waveguide. That signal went down that piece of waveguide, hit the water, got absorbed, nothing came back. It made a perfect dummy load. Water is a good dummy load. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, well, I think you basically answered my question, because I had a problem with working with, a contractor doing antenna work a while ago, and, he didn't seem to think that water caused as much of a problem as having the connector put on properly or having chips across the cable. And I told him, I said, as far as I believe, water will cause you more problem than anything else as far as contamination in your transmission line. He pretty much confirmed it.
You're absolutely right, Joe. If he doesn't do a damn good job of re-waterproofing your connector when he takes it apart, while he's got it apart, he should give it a good clean inspection, blow out any dust and particles, look at it with a flashlight if he's doing the work at nighttime, make sure it's clean, make sure the little tangs in there are not broken, they're mating correctly. He puts the connector correctly back together, torques it the right amount, and then does the weatherproofing job, which probably consists of a stretchy rubberized tape and goo and whatever. But you gotta keep the water out of the system. It'll kill you. And there's a high probability the water is not detectable in the shack. Sometimes it is. Much of the time it is not. You can get a clean measurement of reflected power in the shack, and you can be lulled into complacency of thinking everything's hunky-dory. You can be dead wrong. Until you've done the end-to-end test, until you've done an inspection, you don't know whether or not you've got water in the system. You can't say it with assurance. And with any further questions or comments on this subject, give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thank you, K2I.
Bell recognized. Anyone else?
K1NEP.
K1NEP. K1NEP. Mr. NEP, what is your name, sir?
The call is Kilo 1 November Echo Tango. K1NEP. The name is Steve. I'm located in New York Harbor.
Very fine, Steve. We'll be to you right in a second, right after Mel. K2KEY, the first guy who signed it. Go ahead, Mel.
Mel, if you ever look, after when they install the cable, I got a cable runs up the backyard here. There are tie blocks that hang out in the middle of nowhere, out in the open, with F connectors on them. And the only thing that they do when they put a cable onto it, they crimp it on, and they screw it on. There's no tasting, booting, or anything. I wonder how come it works as well as it does. I would think moisture and corrosion, especially here by the ocean, be the worst. The only other comment I was making to myself, if I stuck a good PDR on a piece of cable that had any kind of, you know, damage to it, do you think that graphically I will see, you know, something that's not true in a cable deck over?
Absolutely. Could answer those in reverse order. In that example I gave earlier where I opened up a piece of Joe's cable that was 50 ohms and I put in a small section of 10 ohm cable and then connected it back together to the rest of the 50 ohm system. You put a TDR on that. The TDR will show you the reflected signal created by that impedance bump in the cable. And if you know how to interpret the TDR signal, the polarity of the signal tells you whether or not the disturbed section you're looking at, X number of nanoseconds downrange, which is X number of feet downrange, whether or not it's a higher impedance, you get a positive voltage, or a lower impedance, you get a negative voltage coming back. So the polarity of the voltage tells you the nature of whether it's a higher impedance or a lower impedance for that section. And if the section, in my example, was a 10-ohm piece of cable that is 3 inches long, assume it was airline, 3 inches long is a quarter of a foot. Quarter of a foot is a quarter of a nanosecond. So you'll get a pulse back on the TDR because it's two-way. You'll get a half nanosecond long pulse that is negative in polarity and fixed in its magnitude of negative polarity during the during the half of the nanosecond, you will get a negative going signal, and the magnitude of the negative going signal will tell you that that chunk of cable is 10 ohms instead of 50 ohms. So the TDR signal, the delay tells you how many feet downrange is the problem. The duration of the bump you get back tells you the duration of the perturbation. The polarity of the return signal tells you whether it's higher or lower impedance, and its duration tells you how long is the error. If the bump was creating a capacitive bump, you get a particular characteristic shape. If it's an inductive bump, you get a characteristic shape. If it's a fixed impedance bump, like I just gave as an example, 10-ohm piece of cable, you'll get a fixed voltage for half a nanosecond in that case. So if you're smart enough to know how to analyze a TDR signal, it'll tell you what is the nature of the error in the cable. A really good TDR, you can see the individual components inside of the connector of the cable. And you'll recognize, aha, I recognize that signature. That's a type N connector made by the Amphenol company. And I'm not kidding. You can tell brand names if you've got a real good TDR. The Steinhelfer type of TDR has enough resolution that you can see the individual components of the connector, and you can tell what brand name and whether or not it was installed correctly. It gives you that much information if you're smart enough to know how to interpret it. Now,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
A real good type N connector, properly installed manually, not a crimp connector, has internally rubber washers and whatever, and it is naturally weatherproofed. If you think you're a lucky person, you can take a type N connector, simply connect it correctly with the right talking magnitude when you put it together outdoors, and you may get no further error or problems for the next 10 years. If you're a conservative person, you like belt and suspenders, you'll do a good job of installing the connector, then you put another layer of weatherizing material on top of it, just to be doubled on sure. If it's a crimp connector, most crimp connectors are not naturally weatherproof. So there is no weatherproofing connection protection within many of the brands of crimp connectors. In that particular case, you've got to do weatherproofing, otherwise you're in a heck of a lot of trouble. So, okay, I think that's pretty much the questions you asked. Let me send it back to you to make sure, Mel. K2KUI, K2RIW.
Edison, K2KUI. Yeah, that's why I brought up the TDR, because that's what I used it for many times to find defects in the cable. And everything I used to recognize all kinds of characteristics after a while, but constantly use that almost every day of the week. The other mention I was the F connector. The cheapest connector I think you can purchase is an F connector. I guess that's why they came out with that for cable. And you look at them over here, they're just crimped on and turned on to that block. The block is even off the open. It's not even in a catheter, you know, casing. And I'm amazed that the cable system works with that type of setup. How they get away with it? It's just crimped on connectors. You see, even on the side of the house, they'll bring, you know, the one drop line from the cable over to the wall, and then they'll split it off into a number of different, you know, rooms or wherever it's going. And sitting right on the side of the wall, just turned on with, you know, F connectors. I don't even know if they tighten them really, that, other than hand tights, but I'm amazed that they work. And even the ones up there on the poles, with the way they, when there's nothing connected, they leave them open. They don't even put a cap on them, stick over.
Yeah, I've seen that, Mel, and I think there's two or three reasons they get away with it. Number one, the signal coming out of the cable system is so strong, particularly in metro areas, that a few sets, the signal is so strong it overrides the dynamic range capability of the automatic gain control. There are some sets in New York City where you must put on a 10 dB attenuator between the cable and the television set so you don't overload the set and stop giving you a ghosty looking picture. So they can tolerate quite a bit of water in the connector, which takes 10 or 20 dB of insertion loss, and if the signal is 60 dB above threshold, you only need 40 dB of signal to noise ratio to get a snow-free picture on television, you can tolerate 20 dB of extra loss with water in the cable. That's one explanation. Another explanation is some of the better-made F connectors with some of the better-made cables do give you a quasi-weatherproofing when the crimp connector is put on the cable. And there is a brand of F connectors which in the rotary joint section of the F connector, there is a kind of a sealing device, sort of an O-ring in there, a tiny little wafer of material. And if you properly torque it up, the connector does a medium good job of weatherproofing. So the combination of a real good connector, properly installed on a real good piece of cable, lets rather little water in, and the system has got such a strong signal to begin with, it can tolerate a lot of loss. That's part of how they get away with it, in my opinion. Let's see what Steve's got to say. From New York Harbor, I think he's probably maritime over.